for our audience at home, let's describe it. Show it to us one more time, Bruce. It's you and I still don't understand why Allen Iverson is Chuck, but it's you and Iverson. What looks like
yes,
yeah,
that's a fake picture. Let's be clear.
Photoshop. It's Photoshop. All the rage.
Yeah.
No,
I can't believe we spent all this time talking about Allen Iverson.
Well, you guys,
and we got the great Bruce Hornsby.
Jordan's
amazing. Yeah, okay. Amazing. Right, it shows you how interested we are in you, Bruce.
Yes. Not
thanks for
much.
Coming on. Okay, yeah, Bruce. Who's our next guest?
Yeah, our next guest is Steve Winwood. He once played Pig with Tim Hardaway. it's great.
Good to see you, Jordan. Hey, listen, I want to tell you a little bit about my weekend because I think you're kind of going to have this experience when Whit gets ready to go to college. So my daughter, Emma, graduated from Ohio State. She graduated magna cum laude. I don't know if I told you that. My daughter, Reese, is either magna cum laude or summa cum laude. We don't know because we don't have the final grades, but both of them are doing well.
You tend to bring that up. That is something you have brought up.
Well, you know, I get my kids get my brains from my wife, and they get their looks from me. No, I'm just kidding. It's both. Okay, but here's what I want to tell you. So we go into Chicago for daughter Reese's graduation, and Emma and I and Karen are standing outside waiting for her to come down from her apartment. And so we hadn't eaten because we were going to go over to they had like a festival, and we were going to eat at the food truck. But I was starving, so I see this McDonald's a couple doors down. And, you know, it's not like the Gold Coast or anything, but it was fine. And I go into the McDonald's, and there's a little kiosk. So I order a hamburger, right? And I'm standing there. I got the hamburger ordered. I got the piece of paper so I can claim my hamburger in my other hand. And I'm just minding my own business. This guy comes over and he like turns his head a little bit and he looks and he says, are you the guy who used to be like the governor of Ohio that I see on television, like on CNN? And I said, yeah. He said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I mean, it's me. He said, well, you got to understand, we don't have a lot of governors that come in here and stand in line using the kiosk, you know, just waiting here for their hamburger to come. And I said, well, you know, that's the great thing about America, right? I mean, a few years ago, I would have had security with me, and they would have probably ordered my own hamburger, but that's what makes America great. So I've gone, you know, from that point to where I'm just standing in line with you, hoping I can get my hamburger. And the guy just cracked up. He was just terrific. And then I walked out, and it was fun, like back to being normal again. You know what I mean? The other thing that happened is my daughter, upon graduation, she's walking down the street wearing her gown, you know, that she just graduated in. A guy walks up to her and says, she's walking with my wife. A guy walks up to her and says, did you just graduate? She said, yes. The guy handed her a $100 bill and walked off. Totally unbelievable. One other thing that happened is Gordon Gee, he's the president of WVU. And so he went to the ceremony. Now, Gordon's not a big, tall guy. He's diminutive. And so this woman walks up to him and says, hey, aren't you the president of the university? And he says, yeah, I am. She said, well, you're awfully small. And he looks at her and says, well, you know, there's no height requirement for being president of a university, which is all the things that happen to Gordon all the time. So it was a lot of fun. You know, it was a lot of fun being in Chicago. A lot of tough things happening up there at night. And one kid shot and killed. Other people shot in that town is just, it's scary when you're there and you hear it and you see it happening. Really scary. But all in all, it was a wonderful, wonderful weekend. How about you?
Are you doing? Governor, what are you doing? You're coming at me. You have to pause. Governor, you used to be governor. You're used to getting your cheeseburgers brought to you on a plate by a security guard. I get that. That's what the taxpayers of Ohio elected and want to pay to happen. But you're also probably used to bringing people in and being like, hey, let's talk about what happened this weekend. And then you tell them the four things that happened to you. And then you send them on their way. But a conversation is where you say one thing, you let the other person say something else, and then it's free flowing. Instead, what I get is three vastly different anecdotes that deal with class, status, and education. Then you offhandedly comment on the violence and the shootings that take place in Chicago. And then you say, what's up with you? That's too much. That's too much for me to wrap my head around and respond to.
It's the good and the bad that we see throughout our lives. So that's kind of what it's about. Well, and you must have had something that happened this weekend that was interesting. I hope you weren't just sitting in your house and having your wife and son have fun and you were just meditating or something. You are stoic, you know, so I don't know what you stoics do.
I'm stoic. I own all the meditation apps, which means I meditate once every 4 months. No, I was sitting here. I was sending people out to get burgers for me, like what successful entertainment people do. I went to the... On the weekends, I try to find fun things to do with my little son, Wit, and my wife. And so we went to the Museum of Natural History in New York, which is a great public resource. And we've kind of figured out it's not really worth it with a 1.5-year-old to go try to see everything. You basically pick one thing and let them run around. And so I take Wit, and we go to one room where there's a giant blue whale that hangs above everything. And we just let him... just run as fast as he could. He ran, he's screaming, he's having the time of his life. We gave him a yogurt packet that he got to run around with. And within 7 minutes, we realized that this beautiful museum was covered in white dots everywhere, which looked like some sort of mistake until I realized that it was the vanilla yogurt that we gave to our child to attempt to pacify him. And we had caused quite the mess. And then when I picked him up to try to take care of it, I also realized the back of my shirt was just covered in yogurt as well. So I was... I was wearing the clothing of a father, a successful father who wants to raise his child in a free society without any rules or consequences. So,
and any dinosaurs? Do they have big tall dinosaurs in there? That scare the living daylights out of them.
They have dinosaurs. An interesting thing is you spend all this time as a young parent teaching your child about dinosaurs for some reason. Apparently, what kids need to learn about is dinosaurs and farm animals. Two things my son will never see in his life. But he knows what dinosaurs are because those are half his books. And then we go to the top floor at the Natural History Museum, and it's all dinosaur bones. And you point, and you're like, hey, Wit, dinosaurs, right? And it's like, no, that's the carcass of a thing that existed millions of years ago. He had no idea what he was looking at. And then when I attempted to explain to him what an epoch was or a global catastrophe was, it was as if he didn't understand me. He was approaching me like he was a 1.5-year-old, which is a shame because he's 19 months old.
Sounds to me like you had fun in there.
It's a good time. A father
good for
of the
you.
Year.
Well, you know, the weekends, now that the weather's turned and everything, I just think the weekends are just putting us in a better mood, better spirit, right? We're having more fun. We can be a little bit more creative. And, you know, I remember when my kids were about 1.5 or 2 years old and bang, you know, the snap of a finger. And there they are graduating from college on to the next chapter of their life. It's really cool. And you're going to love Wit every single stage that he's in as he grows up. You're just going to have a ball.
I will support him all the way through high school. And then I will tell him, whatever you do, don't pay money for college. It's not worth it in the end.
Yeah, but get a good job so he can support you, so he can support dad.
Oh,
okay, I guess we do have a guest here today. Is that right?
We do. We do. We have a guest. We have a very exciting guest. He's an award-winning pianist, singer, and a songwriter. He's a 13-time Grammy nominee with over 23 albums of his own, having sold more than 11 million copies worldwide. He's appeared on over 100 records, including releases with little-known guy Bob Dylan, Grateful Dead, Stevie Nicks, Brandon Flowers, Willie Nelson, many more, and his latest single, Sideline, with Ezra Koenig featuring Blake Mills off his new album, Flicted, is available now. A pleasure to welcome Bruce Hornsby to the podcast. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, guys. It's the JK group here. Have you guys ever had JK Simmons, the great actor, on your show? It's a JK crowd there, so he would fit right in.
You get many JKs in one space at a time, and I think the universe just folds in on itself, so you have to be careful.
Overloads. Okay, right. It becomes one big black hole. Yes, I'm now, you were talking about your kids, I'm now a grandpa. So, yes, I have twin sons, they're 30, and my oldest son by 1 minute, Keith Hornsby, and his beautiful Cajun bride from LSU, where he went to school, they had their first daughter, Lila Hornsby, in Paris, where he plays pro basketball. And so... So they just sent me some hilarious videos. Speaking of yogurt on your back, hilarious videos of the 7th month Lila they're trying to feed her Greek yogurt, and she's just not feeling it with the most beautiful, you know, prune faces. And so, look, we're in those years now, which is great fun. You can have a great time with them, but then when they start acting up, it's like, oh, hey, they're your kid. You deal with it. So speaking of kids, graduates in John's case and baby kids in your 19 months, right? Our kids, well, look, they're older. They're 30 years old. They're supposed to be grown men.
And one of them is a pro basketball player overseas. Is that right? What's that like? Is basketball in the Hornsby gene?
Well, arguably, okay, I played in high school in a very, very tough, great league. I played in the same league as Michael Vick and Allen Iverson did, you know, a few years before that, but same idea. So it would stiffen the spine playing in the Peninsula District here in southeastern Virginia. I did that, but I got more into the piano between junior and senior year. So let the hoops go. It was a good decision. But so then my son came along and he showed an incredible early aptitude, an incredible muscle memory as a shooter at age 3 or 4. You know, at age 5 years old, he could make 34 straight bank shots from 8 feet out on a 10-foot rack. So you go, this is different. And so I said to myself, well, this is something I think I can help him with. And so that happened, and his twin brother, Russell, turned out to be the fastest kid on the playground in second grade. And then that led to him running in college for the great Oregon Ducks, the legendary program. So we had a
Prefontaine. That's Prefontaine territory.
That's exactly right. Steve Prefontaine is the legend. There's been 2 or 3 movies made about him, et cetera. Speaking of Chicago, I played high school basketball against a guy at Hampton High named Steve James, who grew up to live in Chicago, and he made the transcendent, frankly, a film, Hoop Dreams. Came out in the early mid-90s. It's just absolutely
all-time great.
All-time great, top 10 great movie, Steve James. And then he also made a movie about Steve Prefontaine. So he lives in Chicago. So putting Chicago together with hoops and Oregon, it's all connected.
Wait Bruce, I want to connect one more thing because I've heard a little detail that your basketball acumen was actually put to the test against one Mr. Allen Iverson at one point. Is that right?
You know, I never talk about this because it seems ridiculous.
Talk about it, Bruce. The way it is. Talk about it.
Okay, so Allen Iverson was an amazing high school player. He was an amazing high school football player. He led his team, his school, Bethel High School, as a junior to the Virginia State Championship in football and then in basketball. And then he got in trouble. He was with a bunch of guys who got in a big fight in a bowling alley. And he was arrested for, I don't know, maiming by mob, I think was the charge. And he was convicted and sent to jail. He didn't play his senior year in high school. He spent the first 4 months in the Newport News City farm, at the farm. So I thought this was a travesty, a miscarriage of justice. So I started lobbying the governor, who I knew a little bit, and his chief of staff, who I knew pretty well, to maybe overturn, to pardon him. And Governor Wilder did do that, pardoned Allen. We know Allen Iverson as Bubba Chuck or Chuck. That's how he's known in our area. We call him Chuck. If he walked in the room, we would say, oh, what's up, Chuck? Anyway, Governor Wilder did pardon Chuck and his other 3 or 4 guys, friends who had been convicted as well. So about 2 months after this, I get a call from his high school coach, Mike Bailey, who was still the coach at Bethel, because this was still Allen's senior year. So Mike Bailey called me up and said, hey, Allen knows what you did for him, and he'd like to thank you. He'd like to get together somehow and thank you. I said, well, how about if we play basketball? Because I'd been playing a little bit, sort of candy-ass old man's no paint game, you know, didn't want to hurt the fingers. So long story short, a friend of mine was the high school basketball coach here in Williamsburg, and he opened up the gym for us one Saturday, and there were a bunch of witnesses, and I guess I caught him a little rusty because he'd been in jail. And so, but this was a couple of months later. Anyway, we had a bunch of little games, and I just had one of those days where I couldn't miss. And so, yes, that did happen in front of several witnesses.
So you were shooting horse. Let's get to it, Bruce. You weren't really trying to beat him on a one-on-one game, right? It was a shooting game.
No, we played three games of one-on-one and three games of 21. Okay, and here's the way we played one-on-one, which is the way the pros played, and it's the way it should be played. We played two dribble maximum, meaning you start with the ball at the top of the key, and you get two dribbles, and you have to shoot. So it's better for the small guy because the big can just back him in, and throw him some little land hook and do that all day. So you have to commit. It makes it more like a game. So we played two dribble maximum one-on-one, three games.
And Make it take it, twos and ones?
I forget. That's a good question. I don't remember. That's the story. It's completely ridiculous, but I will say that.
Hold on. That's six games, though. You play three one-on-one and three. Did you win all of them? 321? Did you win all of them? Was it a split?
My memory is that it wasn't a split, but my memory could be flawed. Yeah,
you remember every second of that. So what are you kidding us? You know, it's amazing. There's always a story that comes out, Bruce and Jordan, about AI's coming back to play. You know, somebody drafted them for the playoffs, right? And I was messing around with something, just looking at, there was a big feature on him just not long ago. And, you know, that's that famous interview where he says, this is about practice.
Practice, yeah.
This is about practice. Have you ever seen it, Jordan?
We're talking about practice.
And then I didn't realize.
Not a game.
It's not a game. It's practice. Yeah. And I went back and looked at, what's the soccer show so popular on Netflix?
Ted Lasso.
And you got Ted Lasso talking to one guy who won't suit up and go to practice. And Lasso basically takes the script that Allen Iverson did at that press conference. And he pretends he is Allen Iverson. Out of Ted Lasso. I mean, he's legendary.
He's iconic. Yes,
he is. So do you still, what's he doing now? Do you ever see him, Bruce?
I saw him about a year and a half ago. He has the Allen Iverson crossover Christmas classic at Hampton Coliseum. And that was the last time I saw Chuck.
Do you have a crossover, Bruce?
No, I do not. Crossovers weren't really happening in.
Well, I mean, now you can learn.
Yeah, you're more long shot, right? Yeah, you got the fingers of a pianist, which I gotta believe means you're killer at the free throw line.
Man, I don't play anymore. I just rebound. When my son Keith comes home, I just chase his bricks around, rebound for him, and that's it. I have no game now. Here you go. Can you guys see that picture?
Bruce, this is a podcast, to be very clear. This is a podcast. Oh, it's an audio medium. You should be familiar. This
Jordan
is just an auditory.
You can see the picture. That's a year and a half ago, 2 years.
We're looking
for our audience at home. Let's describe it. Show it to us one more time, Bruce. It's you and – I still don't understand why Allen Iverson is Chuck, but it's you and Iverson, what looks like
– Yes.
Yeah.
That's a fake picture. Let's be clear.
Photoshop. It's all the rage.
Yeah.
No question.
I can't believe we spent all this time talking about Allen Iverson.
Well, you guys.
And we've got the great Bruce Hornsby.
Jordan's
amazing. Yeah,
okay.
Amazing. Right, it shows you how interested we are in you, Bruce.
Yes.
Thanks for coming on. Okay,
yeah, Bruce.
Who's our next guest?
Yeah, our next guest is Steve Winwood. He once played Pig with Tim Hardaway. it's great. We'll be right back. And now back to the show. Bruce, you know, I'm going to segue into this, though. Bruce, first of all, you are, I think you're more surprising than people give you credit for. I think it's been fun knowing, I've known for a little while we're going to talk to you, and it's been fun going into your catalog a little bit more. And it is really surprising with the things that you've done over the last couple decades, the people you've worked with, I think, and that's where even the Iverson anecdote it feels like it's full of kismet and what have you. But also, like, there are so many people that have popped up around you in a way that I was totally unaware of. Your relationship with Spike Lee and the work you've done with him, to this new album, Ezra Koenig from Vampire Weekend, Justin Vernon. I think of a lot of people only know you as from 1986 big hits, Bruce Hornsby. They've missed out on sort of who Bruce Hornsby has become and maybe perhaps always been.
Absolutely true.
Yeah. Do you feel like I was laughing. There was a quote of yours that I think is wonderful, but it's also funny when you prep for a podcast. You said, "I'm not going to be a vehicle for your stroll down memory lane," which is powerful. Again, terrifying for somebody who's like, we'll just take a stroll down memory lane and talk. So what I want to know is, I'm in your vehicle. What is the Bruce Hornsby vehicle? If we're not going down memory lane, where are you taking folks?
Meaning, what am I listening to in my car?
I think I was thinking more metaphorically. I mean, literally, oh, okay. I'd like to know, is it the new Kendrick Lamar album? But figuratively, if you're along for the ride with Bruce Hornsby, where are you taking folks?
Oh, just whatever is inspiring me at the time. I'm always looking to be challenged. I'm a lifelong student, and so I'm interested in virtuosity on the instrument, so that leaves me far afield. Unfortunately for my poor unsuspecting audience, it's led me to modern classical music, which is very difficult, dissonant, acrid, astringent music. But I embrace that, and I write songs in that, using that language again, which is not for everybody. It's led me to the bluegrass world with Ricky Skaggs. We made two records in 2008 and 2007, 2013. So proud of them. Jazz world with Jack DeJohnette, Christian McBride. Look, I was always part of it. Bluegrass and country music was always in my early music. Mandolin Rain, for instance, you know, it's about the two of my big hits had me soloing on them. Valley Road and The Way It Is has piano solos, which is very rare on pop radio, almost unheard of. I was able to get away with that a couple of times. So obviously I was interested in playing the instrument well, and that's just led me to this very idiosyncratic journey where I've worked with this disparate group from Spike Lee to Justin Vernon to the Grateful Dead. And that's so where am I taking you? Okay, this is my third record I've made in the last 4 years coming out, Afflicted. And that has a basketball Genesis story as well, the title. But anyway, my next record coming out next year is a chamber music group. It's a record with a group called Y Music, New York Chamber Ensemble, which is also very different. I met them through Justin Vernon. They've been working on my last three records, and we decided to make a whole record just us. So, look, it's all over the map, but I still think that you can hear certain signatures throughout, whether it's bluegrass or jazz or chamber ensemble music, that make you realize it's me.
Hey, Bruce, this, I just don't know how to interpret this. The song you wrote that Don Henley recorded, did you write that song? I mean, did you write the music? What's the story of that?
Yeah, the story is our first record went a long way in a hurry, and so we had to become headliners on 9 songs. That's how the Grateful Dead called us, because we were playing one of their old traditional song called I Know You Rider. We needed to flesh out a headliner's length show with a 9-song record. So we started playing some covers. They heard about that. They liked the music and asked our band to open for them. But then around the same time, Don Henley called out of the blue. He was a fan of what I was doing and asked me if I would be interested in writing a song with him. So it's a co-write. I wrote the music. He came over to my house in Van Nuys, California. And we sat around the piano for a while. Weren't coming up with much. I said to him, Don, I have a track, and I've been trying to write lyrics over this track, but I don't really like what I'm coming up with. Let me go in and record this and come back to my house next week, and I'll give you this recording. So he did. A week later, I been in the studio, recorded this track, played it for him, and he just instantly grabbed it. You know, it instantly grabbed him. And he said, okay, yes, I love this, and I would like to write to it. And he had one of the first big clunky cell phones, you know, the ones that they're as big as your head and or as long as your head. And he called me about 10 minutes later when he was driving back from my house to his house saying, oh, my God, I'm just listening to this cassette, and I've got all these I'm having to pull over the side of the road and write down this. I'm having all these lyrical ideas. And so he wrote it pretty fast, and that's how it started. That's how it became. So it's a Henley Hornsby collaboration.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Jordan. You know the song. It's just such, well, it's so fantastic. But I went on and looked last night at whether your name was in any of it, and here it was like just Don Henley, who I guess is an unbelievable talent. I mean, Glenn Frey once told somebody that, you know, they were upset that they wanted to sing, and they were making Henley sing. A guy looked at, I don't know, one of the guys in the band and said, wait a minute, if Don Henley wants to sing and you think you should, what are you, out of your mind? And I guess Henley's one of the most talented musicians today. But it was interesting, I felt that, like, he didn't say, I want to thank Bruce Hornsby. Does that bug you that you got a sort of no credit for that?
Well, in the credits, it says...
Oh, okay.
In the credits, it says produced by Don Henley and Bruce Hornsby and Danny Korchmar and written by Don Henley and Bruce Hornsby. So on that kind of credit level, I've certainly got it. And he's... we performed it together on the Grammys when we were up for Record and Song of the Year. I think he dropped my name at the end. It doesn't. I don't really feel it's not a problem for me.
It's a beautiful song.
I feel like there are enough people. Your piano is
the song. You know, your piano, the sound, the Bruce Hornsby sound is right there.
The Bruce Hornsby sound.
I don't know why I never
year.
Thought about it before, yeah. but, yeah. you know, it's clear.
Right? I love that you're, Governor, you're fishing for a beef. You're trying to cause drama here. Is this what you want? Is this a ratings plug? Are you trying to start a fight here? This is all about love here, Governor. I don't know what you're doing. Let Bruce Hornsby collaborate the way he wants.
It's all
I'm just trying to look out for him because you're in the beginning of this podcast, you were saying people don't understand everything you've done. Now, this is one of the biggest songs that Don Henley ever sang. And then you don't want to stick up for Bruce. See, I'm here to stick up for people, Jordan. That's what the bottom line is. You think you're up there sticking up for him. Here I am. I'm doing it. And then you're criticizing me for sticking up for Bruce Hornsby. You know, and I say, I'm Don Henley. Who cares? Bruce Hornsby, thanks for being on here. If Henley wants to come on our podcast, the answer is no, at least from me. I'm
Bruce,
sure Jordan will have
Bruce,
him
do
on.
you really feel you need an ex-governor who has trouble ordering a burger by himself sticking up for you? You can handle it on your own.
I can. I have a lot of experience with ex-governors. Mark Warner and Tim Kaine from my state, I've been supporting them for a really long time. Dollar Bill Bradley from New Jersey was a great old friend of mine. He was my boyhood hero when I was in the hoops, and then we became friends once we kind of hit it. He wrote me a letter out of the blue, which of course was amazing for me, and we became friends. And I was his opening act on the campaign trail for many an event in New Jersey. We traveled. That's a different story. So, so I'm fine with ex-governors, ex-senators.
He's a fog. We call them fogs, Jordan. It's called friends of governor. Whoever the governor is, it's not anyone in particular. I just want to be friends with this governor, right?
Yeah, I dropped Doug Wilder's name a minute ago. He was the governor.
Yeah, you did.
But so,
I mean,
so,
you dropped Iverson, you know, now I bring up Henley. We're doing it. You and I ought to collaborate on something here, Bruce.
Kasich Hornsby. Well, it sounds good.
We can put you first.
Oh, Bruce, don't be sticking. You can't be stealing my partner here. For God's sake, I know you're a great collaborator. You work with so many folks, but let me have the governor. For God's sakes, I need this strong, sultry, moderate voice in my life.
You keep him, and I'll go with J.K. Simmons.
You can take Simmons. He's all yours.
I'll take Simmons. Vern Schillinger from Oz, I'm in.
We're talking collaborations. One that I'm fascinated by as well is your Bob Dylan collaboration. I know I saw somewhere that you said Like a Rolling Stone was one of your favorite songs. Obviously an iconic song. Bob Dylan, I know you were brought in to work on Under the Red Sky for his Under the Red Sky album.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm curious what that was like, having had that relationship with Bob Dylan, but you had already had a big career at that point. And from my understanding too, that was a session where they were bringing in a lot of already very established artists to work with Dylan. What was that like to be established, to work with somebody like Bob Dylan? And I'm curious what he would be like in a room in a collaborative setting like that.
Well, it was an amazing time. We recorded at Ocean Way Studios in the hot spring of L.A., 1990 probably, sometime around there. And so he came in. And he was wearing, on a hot day, a hoodie with the hood over, and a baseball cap and the hood over top of the cap. And he had all the, he started emptying his pockets, ridding himself of all these little pieces of paper like this. This is a pod, this is a radio. So, is,
okay, yeah. I'll narrate. It's a small piece of paper.
Hornsby held up a small scrap of paper. Yeah.
Thank you. Audio art form, you understand. I appreciate it.
So yeah, it's taken me this long to get it, but now I think I'm good. So he lays all these pieces of paper out on a table in front of him, and that came in handy a little later on. Then he came over to me and asked me to come over to the piano with him. He wanted to show me a song and then teach it to the guys. So he showed me this gorgeous song called Born in Time, and that was the first song we played. Then we took a break, and Kenny Aronoff, the great drummer, was on drums that day, and he's out there just playing a groove. The rest of us go out there, Randy Jackson on bass and Robin Ford on guitar, and I'm playing the piano. So we're just kind of jamming on one chord and just doing it for a while, just loosening up, having fun. And Bob comes out, and he's just standing there checking us out. And then he goes over to this table, and he looks around, because I'm sitting there playing, watching this. And he's right next to me. And he picks up one of the pieces of paper, goes to the mic, and luckily they were recording in the control room in the booth. He started singing along with us right away with reading these words, and that became the song on that record, TV Talking Song, which is exactly as I mentioned. It's a one-chord song, not unlike Subterranean Homesick Blues. Mm-hmm. One chord, pretty much. Oh, actually, that's not true. Sorry. But there are one-chord Dylan songs that abound out there. But so that was one of those spontaneous moments that can just happen, and sparks did fly. And so that was a great experience. I ended up sitting in with him one time in Portsmouth, Virginia. He asked me to play at the end on the encore All Along the Watchtower. So we had quite a moment there of sort of jamming together. Just amazing. And, you know, speaking of End of the Innocents, you can go on YouTube and hear Bob Dylan singing End of the Innocents. It's the best. It's just the greatest. I guess, 2001, the fall of 2001, I may have this right, he played the End of the Innocents about 7 or 8 times during his fall tour. And there's somebody recording him at all times. It's like there's somebody recording me at all times. That's the world we live in. So you can find that, and it's just the inimitable Dylan stylings on End of the Innocents. So that, what a moment for a songwriter to have the songwriter Nonpareil sing your song. It was just, it's fantastic.
Wow.
You know, Bruce, this, I happen to know Lionel Richie. He's a great guy. And I asked him one time, why is it that some people can keep producing things and other people can't? And he said, well, as long as you don't let the little boy inside of you die. And when we look at you, another album, you know, 23 of them total, you know, what comes to me is, does it just come to you? Have you not let the little boy die inside of you that you just keep going? I just wonder, for both of you, not just for you, but for Jordan, you know, Jordan being a master of comedy, the things just kind of come to you. Do you just sit down and write Age of Innocence, or, you know, that's just the way it is? And Jordan, how about you? I mean, the things just kind of pop into your head. How does it work?
Well, I'm always ready to receive. I've got pieces of paper like this strewn all over my car, my bedroom, the studio where I am now. So I'm always looking for something. I'm always interested in continuing to be creative. It's just what I do and what I most enjoy doing. But a lot of it has to do with also with outside stimulus, affirmation from people you admire. Okay, the reason for 3 albums in 4 years now, 2019 Absolute Zero, 2020 Non-Secure Connection, and now 22 with this Flicted record. Okay, I've known Spike Lee since 2002. We became friends. Our mutual friend Branford Marsalis hooked us up. We had dinner together. I asked him to make a video for me, and he did for my a song from my fourth record, Harbor Lights, called Talk of the Town, about the first interracial romance in my town. So we made this video, became friends. He asked me to write a song for his Clockers movie. Chaka Khan and I wrote a song for his Clockers movie of 95. Kept on going, but it ramped up into a higher gear in my Spike working relationship in 2008 when he called me and asked me to score an ESPN documentary on Kobe Bryant called Kobe Doing Work. I guess it was so I did that. It was my audition. I guess I passed the audition. So for the next 11 years, 08 to 2019, I scored a bunch for him, about 6 different projects. And so in that time, I wrote about 240 different pieces of music, ranging from 50 seconds to 5 minutes long. And during that time, certain of these cues, these pieces of music for score for a film score, started speaking to me, saying, "This I need to be made into a song. I need to develop this." So I had my engineer, Wayne Pooley, make me a file of 14 cues, and I started writing to the cues. And I was giving myself chills while doing this the whole time. It just was a different way of writing, a different approach. And I started playing it for people, and they felt the same way. At the same time, Justin Vernon from Bon Iver reached out to me out of the blue. He'd been shouting me out in the press as someone who had been a big inspiration for him when he was coming up. Then he asked me to come and work with him on some of his projects, on a project, a Grateful Dead a tribute record, for in this case. So all this affirmation, all this attention from Spike and then Justin Vernon coalesced into this record, Absolute Zero, in which I worked with a lot of young musicians from the Bon Iver world on songs that I'd written from cues written for Spike Lee. So this relationship and collaboration begets another. They can combine. So that's the specifics behind this sort of late career renaissance. And the reaction to Absolute Zero, the 2019 record, was so positive around the world from the press. All of a sudden, I was touring Europe again, and I hadn't done it since 2004, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on, but that's the story. And I think it's pretty clear that if someone is giving you this great response, that's inspiring. It makes you feel like doing it some more. And so that's my story.
How about you, Jordan? How do these things come to you?
For me, I think what I hear Bruce saying that resonates so much with me, like I like what Lionel Richie said about like the child inside you letting that live. And for me, that translates to letting somebody let the judgment go. It's so easy. The older you get, it's so much easier to judge what you have, the ideas you have, the ways in which you go. And I think like staying open to let inspiration, but also choices just guide you. I think it's also that the older you get, I've found the more protective you can become towards the things you create, the image you have, the things you do. And I think to be inspired by something new, something you already have. I also think in the creative world, there's painters and there's sculptors, the kinds of people who just want a blank canvas so they can put whatever they have on there. And then there's also the kinds of people who are sculptors who are like, just give me stuff and let me pull away and make something from what is in front of me. I've always found myself more creative with like, oh, I have a thing I need to adapt, or I have all of these other ideas that I'm going to tell myself, I'm going to make something out of what I have here. And so even hearing the stories of like the bits and pieces of music that you had for other projects, using that to inspire the new project to me has always been like, oh, I think so much great art is, for me, it's rarely the whatever the scariest thing for an improviser often is like, you can do whatever you want, go, as opposed to like, make something out of this right now. That to me is always the most freeing challenge of somebody to box you in so that you have to be right. creative within that. And I've always found that to be a much more open space to be than just the complete go phase.
Do you find if you're if you get an assignment, if someone calls you and says, I want you to write for this specific thing, do you find that's a catalyst, a prod, and sort of forces you to be creative? Because that's what I found with Spike. I had to write 40 different pieces of music or so for every film, and that's a lot. And so every time he'd call me, I'd sort of go gulp, but it was really worth it in the end because I amassed all this. So do you have that same? Is that
100%? I love a good prompt of like, right now I'm working on a project that is somebody came to me with. We want to do this specific thing. We want you to bring what you do to it, but you have to do this thing. And to me, that is it's so freeing. I like to have those constraints. I think it's a misnomer to think that those constraints hem you in as an artist. I think there's a Jack White quote that I love that he talks about, like he puts restraints on all of the things that he does. And he talks about putting the microphone, if he knows he can make it from the piano to the microphone in 3 steps, he puts the microphone 5 steps away. So that it's a struggle to do this, but the constraint is part of where something new comes out of. He basically paints himself into a corner so that yeah. there's something interesting there. And to me, that's always been the most fun way of doing something.
So he's giving himself a certain challenge. In that case, a physical space challenge.
Yeah, because probably, and I'm sure you feel, once you reach a certain level of success, and you can do more things. I don't know if that naturally means it's easier for you to do those things you want to do. Like, especially in an industry like music, where you have restraints that are both record companies, and we need you to sell these types of things and to chart in this way. Also, we need you to come in under budget for this, or an audience to respond that way. Like, how did you feel creatively when some of those restraints, I assume, began to be lifted with your success?
Well, I was lucky. People always say, well, okay, so you had this huge hit or 3 hits off your first record. Then was there an incredible pressure from the record company to do it again? I was lucky because The Way It Is was a complete fluke, a wonderful accident. It broke in England. The poor, beleaguered, befuddled BMG promo rep went to his friend, BBC Radio 1 disc jockey, and said, Mickey, me boy, we like this record. It's like, we don't know what to do with it. It's kind of country, kind of jazz. I don't know what. Listen to, give it a listen, mate. And
Bruce, spot on. You nailed the accent.
No, he
wasn't in Australia or New Zealand. Come on. Yeah. Get your mate straightened out here.
Yeah, that's right. No, I'm not going to do my Dick Van Dyke. I'm not going to. I'm not going to try that. So this guy listened to the record over the weekend and went in Monday morning and put this song on the radio, on Radio 1, which was the number one station. And all of a sudden, boom, it just went. Everyone at RCA thought it was a B-side, and that's not an uncommon story. So since they didn't know what a Bruce Hornsby hit was supposed to be, other than I guess there's piano on it, they pretty much left me alone. And so I did not get that. I was lucky in that way. They never did. I was there for 18 years until Clive Davis came in and said, you know what? He heard my latest record, which was pretty adventurous and pretty wild. He said, you know what? This guy, no more. And I was able to walk across the street and sign with Columbia in 2003. But so that was fortunate for me. But they left me alone the whole time. It was very so I'm lucky. I was fortunate.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show.
Bruce, I watched this thing where they were asking you questions, and I found, you know, favorite song, best album, we can get best concert, we can get to that. But the best album I thought it was interesting. It was Elton John, who I guess you know.
Yeah.
And the album, of course, was Tumbleweed Connection. And the song you loved was Burn Down the Mission, which is a great song. You know, I remember the first time I heard Yellow Brick Road, you know, in its entirety, Funeral for a Friend and all that. I don't know how you feel. I've not seen the, you know, I know he's still enormously popular, plays for 3 hours, people love it. But something sort of happened as far as, I mean, once Yellow Brick Road was over, it seemed to become so pop. What do you have a, and so far from Tumbleweed Connection, is that just the way somebody evolves, or what's the story there?
Look, I think that's true. Really, before, I might have my chronology wrong here. Yellow Brick Road did, I think, okay, Crocodile Rock was a hit before Yellow Brick Road, I think. I'm pretty sure
really?
About that.
I don't think so.
Yeah, we'd have to look it up.
Because
there was a turn to pop, but he still wrote some very soulful songs. The song Johnny's Garden.
I don't.
I've been knocking, but no one answers. I've been knocking most of the day. Hey, Johnny. It's a song about John Lennon after he'd been killed, been assassinated. And it's so soulful. But I would say he did take a turn. Look, he started dancing around in Donald Duck costumes at Dodger Stadium or whatever it was. Right, Tumbleweed Connection, Mad Men Across the Water, the first Elton John record with the great Paul.
Mad Men Across the Water, yeah.
It's just fantastic. And it's funny, I said Tumbleweed Connection, and that's probably the one Elton John record of that whole era that did not have a hit single on it. But that's not why I was listening to Elton. I was listening to him because it was deep. I just talked to Elton about a month and a half ago because my new record, Flicted, has a song on it called Days Ahead, and there's a section on it where I thought I might have nicked him, as the Brits would say. I might have a little copyright infringement possibility here. And I was bugging me, and I was losing sleep over it. So finally I said, you know, I'm just going to call him up. But I was going to leave a message. Turns out the number that I thought was his office number was his home number in Atlanta. So the woman, you know, I hear this, hello. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, this is not Hello Rocket Entertainment or whatever it's called. I said, hi, it's Elton there. Who's calling? Bruce Hornsby. Let me see if he's about. Meaning, let me see if he wants to talk to you. And sure enough, about 20 seconds later, passing you through. And so then all of a sudden, hello, darling. And so then I was on with the great one, and we had a beautiful conversation. I told him about my dilemma here. He said, well, you know what my answer is going to be. There's no problem, but please send it to me. And this is a duet with the great Danielle Heim from the L.A. sister group Heim. And so really proud of the song. It's sort of my Brian Wilson moment as a ballad writer.
You've got so many people you've spent time with and you've recorded with. You must pinch yourself at times and say, wow, huh? But you're a great one, too.
Well, I just move forward. Elton and I did a duet. He did a duet with me on my 2004 record, Halcyon Days. It's called Dreamland. So I had my duet moment with Elton as well. So, as a great person. I met him on the Terry Wogan show, sort of the British version of Johnny Carson, when The Way It Is was breaking. We went over there and did that. And he comes roaring in to where I was getting made up. This is before I'd learned how to say no, so I was getting makeup applied, and he comes roaring in a Tina Turner wig and throws his arms around me, and we've been friends ever since. So
that's great.
Yeah, it's been fantastic.
Bruce, it's so interesting to hear you talk about some of the newer stuff you're doing, and I even at the top of the interview, I wrote down you described some of the music that you were creating as acrid, astringent music, which, you know, a PR person might be like, Bruce, those are tough words for an audience to digest. But I imagine it goes to a larger idea that I think is fascinating as artists begin to evolve. I there was a quote, I know you talked about simple music and obtuse music and trying to find that balance in between,
yes.
Which it does feel like even as a fan of music, I both want that music that's accessible enough that I want to listen to and I want to get into, but I also want to be challenged. And I find it as I get older, some music's, I find jazz more because it feels less didactic in what it's trying to tell me lyrically. But then I feel some stuff that might get too obtuse to feel like it's challenging in a way that's no longer something that I want to engage with. Like, how do you balance that equation, and do you see it that way?
Well, I definitely try. I think it's very easy to do something completely out there and obscure, and not. And I also think it's very easy to do something very simple and straight ahead, a sound that we've all heard 1,000 times before. As I get older, I'm usually interested in trying to make a sound I haven't heard before. Different combinations of elements, different ways. For instance, this album starts off with the Ezra Koenig song, Sidelines, and it starts out with backwards piano. You know, kind of like an old Beatles record, really. And so I'm interested in all of that sonic manipulation, the way modern records are made. And then I'm interested in living a black note life. Most people live a white note life exclusively. Live your whole life basically hearing da 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 da. I like I like all of that. So I like to find a place for dissonance for the black notes in pop music. And it's not new, but I feel like I'm trying to find my own way of doing it. I'm influenced by such composers as Elliot Carter, the great French composer Olivier Messiaen, who's well known for going out into the forest and fields of France with score paper he had perfect pitch and transcribing the sounds of the songs of the birds, musique d'oiseau. And he wrote so many pieces, his bird song. And so I have a song where I basically went into Messiaen world, and I don't know how many people like it, but my true devotees who really are interested in adventure and music, they're mad for it. So I'm preaching to that smaller choir because I'm just always, again, looking to push my music and evolve.
Do you care, for the people who, quote unquote, don't like it, how much does that weigh on you at all anymore? Do you get to a point where you don't give a shit, or can you actually ever get to that point? Is that still, is that a false front, or do you feel like you've achieved that?
I'm not sure you can ever get to the point, or I can ever get to the point where it doesn't at least affect me, because I've been getting nasty letters since my second record, which to me stylistically was very much akin to my first record. But I was getting letters from fans going, oh, how dare you change? And that was a little jarring. But my response to it was, well, you haven't seen anything yet. You know, if you really hate this, then you should probably just not come back, because it's going to keep moving forward, because that's who I am. I'm an old music school nerd, an old music school geek, and I'm interested in so much, the broad array stylistically of music, and I'm interested in finding a place in my music for so much of it. But yes, to your point, the nasty letters still abound. They're just on Facebook now, with people going, "Oh my God, why does he persist in doing this stuff? Why won't he just give me my old thing?" And look, I feel their pain. I truly do. Most people go to a concert for their stroll down memory lane, their nostalgic night out, and I understand. You go to an artist's concert because you've loved a lot of what they've done. But for instance, John, if he went to Elton to see Elton, he'd probably really he would be in Nirvana if Elton would play every song off Madman and Tumbleweed. And I don't disagree with that. Although he's got 50 great ones since then, let's be honest, because he's a never-ending creator and has continued to write great songs. I understand the nostalgic night out idea. And look, when I play concerts, I play three or four of the old hits. I hope you recognize them, because they may have evolved to a new place. But yes, so the nasty letters have never abated. They still abound. And I wish they weren't there, but you have to look at life. I get it. Most people make the same record for their whole career. Most artists, great artists who I love, but look, I'm still getting attention from sort of the intelligentsia of the music scene, because they know they're not going to hear the same thing. They're not going to be challenged. It's going to be someone who is truly a seeker of new sounds.
I think that was something I had to learn as a concert goer. You know, I got into Bob Dylan late, and I got to see him. I've seen him a bunch of times recently, and I think he's infamously, you know, as some people hate going there. They expect to see like a Rolling Stone, like they heard on their album 60 years ago, and they're not going to get it. If they get like a Rolling Stone, they're not going to hear, they're not going to understand that it's like a Rolling Stone until about 6 minutes into it. And I think it was curious. There was part of me that was frustrated by it, but I think that quickly got overturned by the part of me that was totally fascinated by, like, what is this person who you have faith in and you love and you trust artistically, what is it that they want to play and find inspired by now? And I think it dawned on me, it was like, he's looking for new applause. And that's what it was like. You can play that song again and get the same clapter you've gotten before. And comics do the same thing as well. And I think creating new sets, there's always a risk there. And I think there's something so beautiful about watching an artist on stage who is searching.
He's creating in the moment every night. He's a true improviser. He's not your pop guy who's going to give you the very faithful recreation, replication of the old record that you've grown up loving. So he's just creative in the moment. He's finding new things. He's searching for new things, new clothes to put on an old body. And so that's totally admirable. I'm the same way. Not as deeply as Bob is, but my job to me is to entertain the band. So I'm always trying to turn something and keep them totally there. You know, we haven't had a set list since 1990. We just wing it. We take requests from the crowd, and it's interesting to find that most of the softcores don't even know we take requests because they're not that deeply involved. But most of the real true devotees, the cognoscenti of Bruce, they don't want me to play old hits.
But that's what's expected, though, of you. And I've got to take an issue with this because I remember going to see Rush.
You're a softcore, Kasich.
Let me just tell you. I'm going to tell you honestly. You know, I pay my money. I want to go see Rush. I want to hear the songs that I'm familiar with. And then I hear them in one concert. It's great. I go to the next one. I'm like, why did I even come here? Because if they want to experiment, fine, then put some music out, let me listen and figure out if I want to hear it. I suppose if I'm going to come see you or go see Dylan or whatever, I have to expect something different. But, you know, we got McCartney on the road right now. McCartney's playing a lot of what people know because that's what people like. And you're there to entertain, unless entertaining for you is watching somebody create something new on the stage. That's where I come from, Bruce.
And you heard me say, I totally understand that mindset. So look, I try to find, again, a middle ground. And actually, okay, so this is a perfect example. You'll appreciate this, John. You might pat me on the back for this. I play solo concerts quite often, just me and a piano. My left hand is my band. And I played a tour. I call it my Deep South tour. It was a Deep South tour. I called it my 5'2" tour because I'm about 5'2" in the Deep South, kind of not big. So I decided that if I'm going to play Mobile and Decatur, Alabama and Oxford, Mississippi and on, I don't expect many people will come, but if they do come, I'm going to try to give them this. So I dutifully remembered to play a hit song every three songs, you know, one hit, two more adventurous searching things, hit, now take you into a crazy place, hit. And so I thought, and that worked pretty well for me. So I may stick with that because look, I want people to like it, but I don't want to be imprisoned by the notion that you have to always do that. Again, I always preface it by, I totally understand if somebody comes, but I can't.
Okay, I've got an idea for you, Bruce. If you want to do that, fine. But let me pay you when the concert's over. Instead of charging me a ticket up front, let me give you what I thought of your show. Now, most people don't want to do that. So if you want me to take a chance on you, you got to take a chance on me. What do you think of that?
This guy's not even governor, and he's already cutting arts funding. Unbelievable.
I guess what I would say to that is no one will ever do that. And so what the concert attendee needs to do is just not come. Vote with your absence. If you don't like it, don't come. Because that's really what I say to people who are haranguing me for working with these young musicians on their records and mine. They're not interested. And again, I understand that. Who cares? Who should care about music? There's no reason anyone should be interested. I'm looking for the 7%, in my estimation, of the population that is looking for what we were just talking about with the way Bob Dylan approaches it or the way I do.
Yeah, and we don't want to be music snobs because people want to go and hear what they have always, what they really appreciate. But you see, that's part of the division. Music should be something that pulls us together, not something where we judge somebody because we don't like the stuff that they like. I mean, that's the problem. And you're a healer, Bruce. You've been all of your lifetime, and I want you to continue to be one. And if you come to Columbus, Ohio, which you probably will at some point, see you.
About 3 years ago, we played their downtown free concert thing. It was a great night.
There you go, a free concert. See? You see that?
Then you can't bitch. Maybe you need to play.
No, you can't. Exactly.
Free concerts, because you can just always walk.
You're great. Thank you.
Great. Well, Bruce, I'm glad you could find one fan who will definitely come to a free concert as long as you play all the hits that he's heard on the radio from years past. What a welcoming audience member, Governor.
Yeah, that's great. That's comforting for me to know that there's... Anyway, thanks, guys.
Yeah, well, Bruce Hornsby's new album, Flicted, is out now. Yes. And see Bruce Hornsby and the Noisemakers live on tour. Go to brucehornsby.com for dates, tickets, and more. Bruce, this has been an absolute delight. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for the plug. Great talking to you guys. And J.K. Simmons, he's up next.
I was gonna, get ready for J.K.
And work on that crossover, Bruce. It's not too late.
Hey, everybody. Jordan here, your favorite host of the Kasich Klepper podcast. Thank you for listening this far. If you like what you hear, click like or thumbs up or whatever icon signifies a positive reaction. We love your ratings. We love your thoughts. Reach out to us on social media. Let us know what you want us to talk about, because I'm tired of answering the governor's questions and I just prefer to answer yours. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon. Kasich and Klepper is a production of Treefort Media, hosted and executive produced by John Kasich and Jordan Klepper. Treefort Media's executive producers are Kelly Garner, Lisa Ammerman, and Matthew Kugler. Line producer is Oscar Guido. Audio direction by Tom Monahan, head of audio for Treefort, with production and editing by Maxwell Carney. Talent booking by Blythe Asher, with additional production help from Tim Schauer, Haley Mandelberg, Colin Motel, and Anastasia Ibrahim. This podcast is powered by Acast.